this administration as authoritarian or fascist, and I'm not saying they're wrong. But what I see is much more of a street criminal, you know, a mob boss, an organized crime enterprise, a con man, a corrupt public official. I mean, that's what we see mobsters do. You know, the classic nice restaurant you have here. It'd be a shame if something should happen to it. But if you only pay me $10,000 a week, I'll make sure nothing bad happens to it.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Stephen Beschloss, and this is Six Questions. I hope you follow Six Questions wherever you get your podcasts. Barely a day passes when we don't see some brazen act of corruption by Donald Trump. You know the story, the myriad ways he's pocketed literally billions of dollars, taken foreign bribes, lawlessly built vanity projects with our money, demanded payments by private businesses, turned our federal agencies into fiefdoms of fealty to himself, ignored the public's interests. It's appalling, it's wrong, and it can feel overwhelming and one of the most serious issues facing America. We need to get a handle on how to confront this. That's why I wanted to talk to Barb McQuaid, the MS Now legal analyst, University of Michigan law professor, and author of the new book, The Fix, Saving America from the Corruption of a Mob-Style Government. So let's get started. Barb, it's a delight to be able to talk with you. Your book, The Fix, it's an important contribution to our understanding and our thinking about how to confront the government corruption we're facing. So I'm glad that you're joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Delighted to have a conversation with you. I've admired your work for a long time.
Thanks so much. So first, let's go back in time. There are so many legal issues that surely cross your desk. You know, why did you choose government corruption as the topic for your book?
Well, you know, this is a book I started to write because of things I was seeing in the Trump administration that reminded me so much of some of the crimes I prosecuted as a prosecutor. And so what I hoped to share with the public was maybe a fresh look how I was seeing through my lens as a prosecutor, former prosecutor, of some of the conduct of this administration. You know, there are people who talk about this administration as authoritarian or fascist, and I'm not saying they're wrong. But what I see is much more of a street criminal, you know, a mob boss, an organized crime enterprise, a con man, a corrupt public official, because what seems to be the big MO for the Trump administration is the use of extortion, using leverage, finding somebody's weakness, and then exploiting that weakness to obtain leverage over them, to coerce them to come to the table and negotiate their own punishment. I mean, that's what we see mobsters do, you know, the classic nice restaurant you have here, it'd be a shame if something should happen to it. But if you only pay me $10,000 a week, I'll make sure nothing bad happens to it. And it's the same kind of thing we see with President Trump, the way he's approached law firms with these ridiculous executive orders, trying to bring them to the table, or the media with defamation lawsuits, or foreign allies with tariffs, or universities by taking away their grant money. All of these things, it seems to me, are looking to other centers of power in democracy and trying to silence them or bring them to their knees.
Yeah, and I saw that, you know, I mean, your mob style surely caught my attention. And I noticed that you made reference to the fact that Donald Trump finds Al Capone particularly appealing, maybe a model for him. Are there other examples just from your own work that sort of like, oh, you know, Trump is just like X?
Oh, sure. I think about a number of different cases. We had a corrupt public official in the city of Detroit, the former mayor, who used his ability to award public works contracts to extort payments. You know, he was just looking for cash, but it was the same kind of thing. I have you over a barrel. I have the power to demand this thing of value from you, and I'm going to do everything in my power to force you to come to the table. I think that's similar. I also think about some of the con men that we prosecuted. You know, having the trappings of power is a very important part of the game. And so con men would often dress in expensive suits and silk ties, gold bracelets, driving the Ferrari, because they had to have the image of power, not just power itself, or the image of success to suck people in. And I think one of the things that President Trump does is by putting his image everywhere, I think that's, you know, one part narcissism, two parts power play. So certainly there's some narcissism, putting his name on everything. But I also think it's something he learned in his business. I think Roy Cohn was an incredibly influential figure for Donald Trump. But I think that he learned that by putting your picture on everything, you are stamping yourself as the owner and as more powerful than maybe you really are, and causing people to think fighting back and resisting is futile. Because he's everywhere and he's powerful and he has taken over the government as his own.
So I'd like to share two questions you ask in the early pages of your book, and I'm going to read them. What happens when the leader governs through mob-style corruption, cruelty, and chaos? When a president claims that our system of government is so broken and that he is so all-powerful that he alone can fix it. So we're surely watching this play out with Trump's vanity projects. I'm thinking of the ballroom, stock trading, crypto, money-making, taking of foreign bribes, handing out pardons like candy, poisoning federal agencies to become bastions of loyalty, raking in billions. So in your estimation, it's a lot, and there's more than that. Which of these are most dangerous for our democracy, and how difficult will this all be to overcome?
Yeah, I think one of the things that President Trump has done is recognized that he has now achieved this place of power where he can loot the federal government because his voters have given him license to do so. You remember he famously said way back when he was running in 2016, that I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and not lose any votes. And how did he develop?
It seemed hyperbolic at the time.
It did, but I think he's reached that point where maybe he's there. I don't know. I kind of get the feeling that maybe the tide is turning a little bit. But what he did was to cultivate a following that was based on the leader in the personification of Donald Trump, as opposed to democracy or a system of laws or our government, which he persuaded everybody was corrupt, was a swamp, was rigged against the common folk, and that he was going to come in and fix it for the common folk. And how did he do that? I think he did it by exploiting some of our differences in society. Instead of blaming a two-tiered financial system that has cut taxes since the 1980s, has moved good jobs offshore, has allowed the skyrocketing of CEO salaries. Instead of saying that's what has caused families to feel left behind financially, what he has said is it's those immigrants, it's DEI, it's minorities, it's the transgender community. I think he has built a loyal following of telling some people what they have wanted to hear and posing as their champion. And I think as a result of that, when he goes after other people or when he even enriches himself, as he said in the New York Times, he's learned people don't care. They don't care that he's looting the government because he's convinced that everybody in government is corrupt. And so if everybody in government is corrupt, I might as well have the guy who shares my values. And so I think that's where we are at this moment. But what I hope the fix suggests is we don't have to stay there. Yeah. And I've also learned that con men ultimately fail on their own, if we leave them alone long enough, because people realize that they are not providing what they promised. Yeah. And so if they can't follow through and deliver, people notice and move on. But I'm hopeful we don't have to wait for that we can take our power into our own hands and not just wait for him to fail on his own.
Yeah, and I want to get to some of those fixes, and I want to talk a little bit more deeply about the ignoring of the interests of the people, and you know how that actually sort of plays into what corruption is. But I want to linger first. I mean, a third question about the scale of corruption, about him essentially sort of poisoning the whole well, but also specifically the brazenness of it, right? Yeah. As if this is Trump's God-given right, you know, never mind the Constitution or the rule of law, you know, that in essence that it's okay what he's doing. Does the brazenness make it harder to fix?
I think in some ways it does, but in other ways it may be easier. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things, you know, President Trump early in his second term posted that image of him as a king on social media and wrote something like, Sometimes it's necessary to break the law to lead the country. You know, the leader needs to break the law. He's been sort of normalizing this idea that the president is above the law. And he even got, I thought, a real boost in that when the Supreme Court that ruled that a president is immune from criminal prosecution for acts committed while in office. That was like, you know, a license to play for Donald Trump. But I do think the brazenness is some of it that, you know, he has, I think his fixation.
It's gotten harder just to know what's a crime and what isn't a crime, right? In other words, it's not only the number, right, the constant flood, but it's also like he does it, you know, with obviously with a sense of immunity, but also a sense of, you know, impunity, because like, well, I'm not really doing anything wrong. So it gets harder for people to almost grasp it or fathom, you know, what the seriousness is.
Well, I think he did a few things to really lay the groundwork for what he's doing. One is to go after Joe Biden as a criminal, the Biden crime family. I mean, certainly Hunter Biden engaged in some bad conduct, but, you know, trying to say that there was corruption in Ukraine and elsewhere, to suggest that Joe Biden had weaponized the Justice Department against him and against the public and his supporters. And his evidence for that is his own indictments. And the indictments against the people who committed the attack on January 6th. I mean, a real effort to just rewrite history there. And so, you know, there's this argument. We see this in Putin's Russia as well, where the public just becomes very cynical and believes everybody's corrupt. What's the big deal? All of them are corrupt. I also think one of the things President Trump has done is he has engaged in corruption in its generic sense, if not in its literal legal sense. I think at the time of the founding, our founding fathers thought of our leaders as being not only beholden to what the law required, but also beholden to civic virtue, and that they should aspire to lead in a way that is for the good of the public. There's a theory in law that Oliver Wendell Holmes once espoused, which is the bad man theory of the law. You know, the good man will follow the law because it's right to do so. He wants to avoid the penalties, but he also follows the law because it's the right thing to do. So if I were to enter in a contract with you and you're a good man, you would honor our contract, not just because you want to avoid the penalties, but because your word is your bond and you want to follow through. The bad man will look at the contract and say, well, you know, I could follow through on this, but I've got a better opportunity. This is going to cost me money. I'd rather sell my goods to this other guy where I can make a lot more money. And so all I have to think about is, what's the legal consequence? Maybe I got to pay some damages for breaching my contract, but the hell with that. I'm doing it and I'll just pay the penalties because I can get more money this other way. That's the bad man theory of the law, that I'm looking for the loopholes. I'm looking for the angles. I'm looking to manipulate it. And I think we expect a president or a leader to lead in a way that is not the way maybe an ordinary private litigant is, who's always looking for the tax shelter, looking for the way out. And I think that's one of the ways that President Trump has governed, is not following norms, not following legal traditions, not following the modest examples of George Washington and others, but looking for the gaps, right? Like, can I redefine birthright citizenship by taking this clause, what subject to the jurisdiction thereof means, and create my own definition? The Constitution says I can't accept any foreign emoluments, but, you know, Saudi Arabia offered me, Qatar offered me this plane, and he said, I'd be stupid. I'd be a stupid person to take it.
Forget but the law. This is now the law of stupidity or not stupidity.
Yeah. But, you know, he's also gamed it that although the Constitution forbids it, there's no specific penalty for it.
Yeah.
You know, maybe the penalty is impeachment, but he knows that with this Congress, with a Republican majority, he's probably not going to get impeached. So he can violate some of these provisions without any consequence. So I think first by conditioning the public and then by looking for all these loopholes in the law, he has found a way to maybe follow some of the technical requirements of the law, but not that civic virtue that I think we should expect as citizens.
Yeah, you mentioned in the book the quote from Montesquieu, talking about sort of the virtue being connected to a love of equality, that is sort of in opposition to the corrupt one. In essence, you've queued up my fourth question. You also write about corruption in terms of the absence of virtue, but the failure to serve the public's interests over private interests. given that Trump is a bad man, right, who lacks virtue and learned from Roy Cohn to ignore the rule of law and manipulate the judicial system to his own advantage, what system-level problems are most responsible for exacerbating the corruption? I'm thinking about the immunity-granting Supreme Court, you know, obedient oligarchs seeking favor, spineless Republicans who look the other way as they shirk their constitutional duties.
Yeah, I think all of them, and I think they have acted out of a combination of fear and greed. So when we look at some of the, you know, the tech bros who once opposed some of the things that Donald Trump said in his second term, I think they realize, number one, if we, you know, make him some donations for his inaugural galas and stay on his good side, that could benefit us. You know, we're the companies who are going to get the big government contracts. This could be very lucrative. So I think that's where greed comes in. But I also think fear is an element of this. When you look at the media, some of these big media entities that have caved on defamation lawsuits that were, you know, just laughably frivolous. But I think they acted a little bit out of greed, but also out of fear. When we've got an FCC director in Brendan Carr who threatens to take away a broadcast license, I mean, that could be devastating for a broadcast media outlet. Or they hold the cards in whether your merger gets approved. I think that's a real fear and also some greed attached to that. Or when they can initiate enforcement actions against you. And the president has shown the willingness to target enemies. I think that's a reason for fear to play out. So the president has stoked fear and exploited greed, I think, to get where he is. Congress certainly has a role to play in all of this. You know, you talk about Montesquieu talking about the separation of powers, right? That's where that idea comes from, that we should have power not consolidated in one person, but in different entities where we come up with our three branches of government. Congress has really fallen down on the job. You know, we're supposed to have a separation of powers, and instead, it seems that we have more of a separation of parties. If you've got Congress in the bag, then you can get away with anything, because now, especially since the court ruled this in this immunity decision, the only way to hold a president accountable really is through Congress, through oversight hearings and exposing wrongdoing to the public, or impeachment. And all you have to do is threaten a primary against a member of Congress, and so many of them fold. It's really a disgrace. You know, we've got a few standouts like Liz Cheney or Adam Kinzinger who were willing to risk their position in Congress to stand up for what they thought was right. And they, you know, their reward was to be primaried, or in the case of Adam Kinzinger, to resign from office, to lose their jobs. But why do you want to be a member of Congress if you're not going to stand up for the reasons you sought the job in the first place? But there have been, you know, shockingly few members of Congress who've been willing to stand up to the mob boss.
Yeah. So we'll put aside for a moment their cravenness, you know, their need for proximity to power and all the benefits that come with it. The other side of it, which I want to linger on for a minute, is the, as you put it, the broligarchs, right? The billionaires, as if their billions, you know, do not cushion them from the same, you know, fear and need to bow down to Trump. You know, I mean, I'm thinking particularly about the grotesquely rich and powerful Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg, for example. So what does this say about the need to address income and wealth equality as inequality, rather, as part of the picture of dealing with corruption?
Yeah, I think the solution has to really focus on the growing inequality that we are seeing in our country right now. You know, this moment in history, your historian, really reminds me of the Gilded Age, when we had the robber barons. You know, their industries were railroads and oil and banking, but they really exploited their power, and they built monopoly power, gouging consumers and creating this huge wealth disparity. We had Theodore Roosevelt come along and speak out about this, a Republican, and he was able to bust up the trusts with antitrust laws that made these companies smaller and more competitive and took away some of that monopoly power and gave more power, relatively speaking, to the workers. We had child labor laws that came along. We had food and drug laws that protected consumers from these filthy conditions. And we had the preservation of our national parks so that it wasn't just the wealthy who could enjoy the natural beauty of the United States. I'd love to see a movement like that again. And I do think there's a path to victory there. I think we're starting to see this with some of the progressive candidates. We saw this in Hungary when Peter Magyar ultimately defeated Viktor Orban. One of the ways he did that was by speaking out against the corruption of Viktor Orban, but also by cultivating a coalition of both the progressive votes and the populist voters who had voted for Viktor Orban because they felt left behind. I mean, helping them realize that part of why you're left behind is because of people like Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg and these billionaires who are gouging us, and helping them to see that. I think that if we could get those voters together in a coalition, we could make a path. You know, affordability is becoming an important issue. Donald Trump's sneers at the issue of affordability, but that is something that matters to his voters. And so I think that the candidate who can appeal to people on the basis of affordability across the aisle, I think is one who can be successful to overcome this moment. And boy, do we need it. The wealth disparity in this country is larger than it's ever been. And I believe it contributes to the discontent in this society. I cite in the book one of these studies about the happiest countries in the world. And they aren't necessarily the richest countries in the world, but they are the countries that have the least amount of wealth disparity, because it's the anger of seeing somebody else is, you know, living high on the hog, and I'm working two jobs or three jobs and barely making ends meet. How can this be? Or my illness is going unaddressed when you've got these people with, you know, three homes and seven boats. Like, how can that be? And so I think that growing disparity in wealth is causing a lot of the dissension in society.
Yeah. I mean, I've just gotten back from Finland, in fact. So
Great example.
You know, maybe a best example, not the only one, but exactly where the not only the relative equality in terms of income levels, and it's grown there somewhat, but also the commitment to having equality in education across the country, wherever you come from. So there's really opportunities that go to people from, you know, who come from poorer areas or rural areas or so on. You know, they're not at a disadvantage because the system has been created to ensure that they get a relatively equal education.
Yeah, I think the concept of equality is essential to the United States. You know, certainly it's in our Declaration of Independence. It was at the refounding at the time of the Civil War. Abraham Lincoln, leaned into those words. But there is a movement. You know, I think for some of us, it's beyond comprehension that anyone would disagree with the idea that we're all equal and we're all entitled to equal opportunities in this country. But there is a movement, a political movement that says, no, like there's some people who just need to do the menial work in society. They're not equal to the challenge. Or, you know, some of these technocrats who want a autocracy led by, you know, technical experts who say that, you know, we should have one leader who's calling the shots, and there are people who don't want to be bothered with these things. They should just go out and work and enjoy their work. What? You know, I think most of us grew up believing in democracy, believing in equality, at least, you know, in equal opportunity, and equality in education is so critically important to that. You know, I talk in the book a little bit about some policy ideas. You know, it's not enough to say we care about democracy. What are you for? You can't just be against a certain group. And I think some of these things to restore equality are really important. Good jobs, but also good education. And I think this movement to, you know, have school vouchers and other kinds of things just drains public education from its resources. That's part of the social contract, that everybody has an opportunity for a good education. And that is the way out of one social class and into the next.
Yeah, I mean, one other aside, which, well, maybe it's kind of a two-part aside, which is, you know, maybe the broligarchs ought to, you know, read up about the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution when people decide that, you know, they've had enough of extreme inequality. You know, and if you look at something like, well, Upton Sinclair and you know, turn of the century book, The Jungle, I mean, it had the ability to convince, you know, Teddy Roosevelt to pursue, you know, Food and Drug Administration and you know, labor laws, exactly because what Sinclair described shocked the nation's consciousness and conscience. And you know, it seems that we're living in a time where shocking the nation's consciousness and conscience has gotten a little bit harder.
Yeah, maybe so, but I don't think it's futile. You know, you look at how public opinion can change on a dime. Mm. It's so interesting. I mean, you think about the George Floyd death, the Me Too movement. Sometimes, like, it can just be one issue that really causes the public to notice. You know, there was the Senator McCarthy, have you no shame, right, in his Red Scare. And so you never know what might break through. It's why it's so important, I think, that we have journalists, historians, authors, and activists out there trying to capture the public attention. Because Nancy Pelosi is fond of saying this, but Abraham Lincoln said it too, which is public opinion is everything. Mm. Without it, you can do nothing. With it, you can do anything. And I think that ultimately public opinion is really important. President Trump, you know, took Steve Bannon's advice, I think, to flood the zone with so much outrage that it's very difficult to focus on any one thing. And I think that is a distraction. And then he has things like, I'm going to rename Lake Ontario, or I'm going to rename the Gulf of Mexico, you know, shiny objects to get people distracted from what's really important. But I do think that speaking out against injustice is very important and ultimately can resonate. One other work that was important at the time of the Gilded Age was Jacob Riis, who wrote How the Other Half Lives. And he described in great detail how people were living in tenements in absolute squalor. And sometimes good people just don't know about it. They have no idea. And so by exposing some of these things, you know, I think right now what's going on with some of the immigration enforcement, you know, we have immigration laws, we should enforce them, but we don't have to do so with such cruelty.
Yeah.
And also, I think we should do it with an eye toward public safety, not just numbers games. And so, you know, sitting in the parking lot of a Home Depot, you might be able to scoop up a whole bunch of undocumented people, but are they the right undocumented people? Let's look for the people who are posing a danger to us. And so I think that journalists and others who share the stories of some of the cruelty that we're seeing can really help shed light on just how what a foolish strategy the Trump administration has pursued in the way it has enforced immigration law.
So a fifth question, you include a chapter on the need to implement new guardrails to check presidential overreach and corruption. Well, of course, many of us believe that such guardrails already existed, but we've learned how weak they are in the face of a man who ignores the law as well as norms and traditions. So, you'd have to tell me everything, but what are a few suggestions that you think are critical to address the lawlessness and unethical behavior, you know, looking toward the future?
Yeah, I'll just name a few. So I think one of the things we can do, Congress can do, is to impose certain qualifications on cabinet officials and other presidential appointees. Most of those positions do not have any qualifications. So, for example, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, maybe that ought to be a doctor or a scientist, instead of, say, RFK Jr., so that you get somebody who knows a little bit about what it is they're talking about. Some expertise. How about that? And we have a little bit with the attorney general. It says that the person should be learned in the law, not much more than that. The Secretary of Defense should be somebody who's been out of the military for at least 7 years, though sometimes they get waivers on that. So, you know, what if we had some more structure there so that we could keep out people, you know, like Secretary McMahon at the Department of Education, whose background is in professional wrestling. Like, how about, you know, somebody who's actually got a background in this area? I think that's one thing we could do. Over at the Department of Justice, you know, which is near and dear to my heart, I spent 20 years working there, where we scrupulously followed all of these norms, like partisan politics should play no role in charging decisions, and there should be no direct communication between the White House and the Justice Department on specific cases, lest there be not only interference in cases, but even the appearance of interference in cases. I think rather than simply have these in memos and policy manuals, we need to put them in the law. Now, I think we'd have a separation of powers issue if we had Congress legislating in this space, but the executive branch could create its own regulation and put it in the code of federal regulations after a notice and comment period. That would make it much harder for a future administration to simply ignore it, because it would be a federal regulation. I finally think that the president should be included in the code of government ethics. Right now, the government ethics laws apply to everybody else in the executive branch, but not the president or the vice president. And so, you know, you have rules about reporting about your income. You can't take gifts from other people. It would prevent the president from accepting gifts like a plane from the government of Qatar. Even though we have it in the emoluments clause, it would put some teeth there to have it enacted in a statute.
Yeah, I mean, it's ethical code of conduct. We wish that the Supreme Court actually had one that they were committed to. I mean, this is, you know,
yeah,
this is one of these ongoing questions. You know, how do you make sure that there's real enforcement in these things? And that's, I think, what we've been finding again and again. You know, the guardrails assume that you have if not a virtuous person in office, you have somebody who actually thinks that the rule of law is their responsibility to follow.
Yeah, and sometimes I know I've heard it said, you can have all the policies in the world, but if you have someone determined to find all the flaws in it, you know, the bad man again, to look for all the loopholes, you're never going to completely corrupt-proof the system. You need to elect better people. And yeah. So I would suggest that when we see candidates on the campaign trail, we ask them about their view of the proper role of the Justice Department. And we demand that we have candidates in office who understand it is not their personal law firm. It is not there to target their own political rivals, that we have a rule of law in this country, and the Justice Department's job is to uphold it.
You're bringing me to the sixth question.
Perfect. So,
it's a big, broad question, but let's go for it. Why do you think so many millions of Americans chose a corrupt mob-style boss who ignores the rule of law, trashes the Constitution? What does it say about our democracy, about the kinds of leaders that people are attracted to, and the power or the lack of power of foundational values like equality and the principle that no one is above the law?
I think it's not a coincidence that Donald Trump came along right about the same time as social media. I think that social media has given us the ability to pander to people's prejudices, whether that's hardcore religious right, and it's all about the abortion issue, or demonizing people based on their immigration status or the transgender community. There is the ability to unleash bots to make it look like a message is far more popular than it is. Mm-hmm. We use social media influencers now. There's been reporting even the military is using social media influencers to influence public opinion. And so I think that some people have been fooled. I also think that there has been an exploitation of our differences, of really digging in and pushing public opinion to the extremes. And so I think that's a big part of it. It gives me hope, though, that we will overcome this moment as we become a more mature society. I think we already have learned through Robert Mueller's investigation that not everything on the internet is what it appears to be. Mm-hmm. Right? We know that there were all kinds of Russian actors there, posing as ordinary Americans and pandering to certain constituencies, coal miners and religious voters, voters in Texas, also pandering to people on the left, calling themselves Blacktivist and United Muslims of America. Mm-hmm. So not everything is what it appears. I think it might get worse before it gets better with AI. You know, we're seeing now all this AI imagery of people doing things we have
not. It's harder and harder to differentiate.
Yeah, but that's where I think that we need some real regulation in the internet and in social media. I think we can do it without violating anybody's First Amendment rights, requiring more information like labeling when something's been AI generated, I think would be a way to help people recognize that which has been fabricated and that which is real. I mean, I see all kinds of stuff on my feeds now about cute animals and cute babies doing ridiculous things that I know just can't possibly be natural. And we're starting to see it in political ads as well. And so meaningful regulation. But of course, that's where the billionaires come in, because their dollars are preventing it. I also think it's no coincidence that President Trump comes along at a time when we're seeing repercussions of the Citizens United case that was decided in 2010. That case opened the floodgates to big dollars. And so if you're a billionaire and you want to avoid regulation and you're Elon Musk, you know, you just throw hundreds of millions at your preferred candidate. And so that goes against the idea of equality as well, that every one of us has the same influence in the outcome of an election. We really don't. The billionaires have a thumb on the scale. And so I think we need to get our arms around that as well.
a little more media literacy, a little bit more education, maybe a little bit more civics education. I think all of those things would help. So so your book surely helps in the education department, and so does this conversation. So I appreciate it. But before I let you go, a lightning round, six more questions.
Okay.
You can answer with one word or a sentence or two. Are you ready?
Ready. Let's go.
What makes you happy?
Oh, spending time with my children. Seeing my children happy makes me happy.
What makes you angriest?
Corruption, injustice. It's probably why I became a lawyer. Unfairness, especially to groups like women, minorities.
What is your best way to relax?
Exercise, run, tennis, lifting weights.
Advice for everybody who's listening. What living person do you most admire?
Ooh, what living person do I most admire? Well, probably too easy, but I sure admire Barack Obama. I thought that not only did he was he incredibly talented with his rhetoric and style, I thought he had an unflappable demeanor that was served as a great role model for leaders in government. Right down to the tan suit, right?
if it worked for him, no matter whether people thought it was a scandal or not. So
yeah.
What historical person do you most admire?
Oh, you know, this is somebody not known to everybody, but it's Frank Kelly. Frank Kelly was a lawyer in Michigan. He served in every role. He was the governor of Michigan. He was the mayor of the city of Detroit. He was an attorney general and a Supreme Court justice. When he was at the Justice Department, he created the forerunner of the first ever civil rights division of the Justice Department. And then, of course, he became a Supreme Court justice, and he was the lone dissenter in the Korematsu case. And so I have always looked, you know, I probably knew his name because there is something in Detroit called the Frank Murphy Hall of Justice. It caused me to explore who he was. And I think he really embodies what a person can do with the law to make it better for society.
Frank Kelly sounds like somebody people need to do some research on. Last one, what gives you hope?
Our democracy, our ability to change. We have been through some really rough times before, whether it was slavery, the Civil War, World Wars, Jim Crow, all kinds of things. And our system allows people to change the way our system works. There's a lot that's broken right now. I think this wealth disparity is a really important part of it. But there are more of us than there are of them. And through peaceful protest, I think we can achieve things through organizing, through getting out the vote, through information. I think there are a lot of ways all of us have power to be part of the solution. And I encourage people to do that. We've got an election ahead of us in November, and we all have the power to be part of the solution. So that gives me hope.
Yeah, the collective force that is actually stronger than even a corrupt president if deployed. So couldn't agree with you more. Thanks so much for this conversation. Really appreciate it, Barb.
Oh, you bet, Stephen. My pleasure to be with you.